Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Tuesday, April 21st, and this is the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, a packed one as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, if I may say so, this feels resonant. Like the way a cathedral's architecture shapes and amplifies sound, these themes, geopolitics, macroeconomics, AI, they're all reinforcing each other, creating a powerful current.
Resonant. You and your analogies. But you're not wrong. We're starting with the hotspots. Energy markets are shifting fast, and regional escalation isn't just a possibility, it's increasingly priced into the market. What's the real breaking point, Alex?
There's a signal here that leads us directly into the macroeconomic fallout. Did you know wealth disparity has reached levels not seen since? Well, let's just say it's a worrying historical parallel. We'll unpack the rise of national champions and whether they're a solution or just fueling the fire.
Fascinating, but while governments wrestle with the big picture, the real action is in enterprise AI adoption. But it's not just about who is adopting, it's about compute power. Are we heading for a silicon crunch?
A brilliant question, Maya, and one we'll absolutely tackle. You know, sometimes I think we spend so much time on the algorithms, we forget the fundamental limitations of.
Hold that thought, Alex. We'll dive into the hardware bottleneck right after the break. Stick around. Oil prices recently jumped 7% to around $88 a barrel, and Citigroup is predicting $110 if the Strait of Hormuz stays disrupted. Let's talk about the US-Iran conflict and its cascading effects on global energy security, basically the mess that's likely to get a lot messier.
That $88 figure is a critical baseline, but the potential for $110 or higher isn't just about immediate supply shocks, it's the systemic risk exposure. Helen Thompson's analysis, particularly referencing the 2019 Saudi oil facility attacks, underlines how quickly regional escalation can rewrite energy market assumptions. And crucially, it isn't just about securing oil for the US.
Right, it's not a simple case of Uncle Sam needing cheaper gas. This seems to be about containing China, even if it means, well, causing chaos.
The framing from Thallerson and Thompson makes that abundantly clear. Renewed engagement in Venezuela and Iran aren't purely about energy reserves. It's about resource competition with China, leveraging any available asset to counter Beijing's influence, even if those assets aren't strategically vital in themselves. It's a long game, though the execution is still deeply uncertain.
So it's like a complicated game of geopolitical chess, where the pawns happen to be incredibly valuable oil fields. What about Iran's? A two-week ceasefire that's unlikely to extend, that sounds like a scheduled escalation.
The reports of Iran's willingness to escalate are deeply concerning. The attack on the Qatari LNG facility is particularly startling, as Thompson points out. It reveals a deeper level of regional animosity than commonly understood. More broadly, the potential tolls on ships in the Strait of Hormuz demonstrate a direct intent to destabilize, which makes the ceasefire expiration on April 22, 2026, particularly fraught.
Tolls? That's a polite word for extortion. And China is just sitting there, heavily reliant on that same waterway.
China's vulnerability is the core of the issue. They have substantial investments in Iran and depend on hydrocarbon transit through the Strait of Hormuz. This makes them uniquely exposed, as Thompson highlights, even more so than their dependence on the Malacca Strait. It's not just a current conflict issue, but a systemic vulnerability. Past conflicts haven't fundamentally disrupted the waterway, but that doesn't guarantee future stability.
So China's basically holding its breath, hoping everyone plays nice. That seems optimistic. What's the Gulf states' reaction been? Are they just letting the two superpowers duke it out?
That's where it gets complex. The Gulf states' potential realignment of alliances is critical. Thompson emphasizes that their perception of U.S. commitment is key. The 2019 attacks on Saudi oil facilities are a potent reminder of their vulnerability and the potential for the U.S. to not fully protect their interests, leading to a reassessment of priorities.
A reassessment meaning flirting with China.
Not necessarily proactively. Thompson suggests a shift towards China could be driven by anger over perceived abandonment by the U.S., not necessarily a desire for partnership. If they view Iran as the primary instigator and the U.S. response is seen as inadequate, the equation changes rapidly.
I'm picturing a very awkward diplomatic dinner where everyone's sizing each other up. What about the impact on the ground? Has this regime change effort actually, you know, changed the regime?
Unfortunately, it's backfired spectacularly. The U.S. and Israel's targeted assassinations, intended to trigger collapse, demonstrably consolidated power within the hardline elements of the Revolutionary Guard. The installation of Mashtaba Khamenei, whose selection was unlikely without the war, is a significant turning point.
So the attempt to remove one extremist installed an even more extremist. That's not ideal.
It's a clear case of unintended consequences. The war inadvertently created momentum for Mashtaba Khamenei's succession, even despite his previous lack of prominence. Reports of his injury during the strike compounded this, necessitating a clear successor to project strength. This has solidified the role of the Revolutionary Guard and a more conservative path for the country.
And now they're negotiating from a position of strength, holding the Strait of Hormuz hostage.
We can trace that further. The current defiant posture is strategically enabled by this newfound leverage. Thompson notes that this has energized elements within the Iranian government, allowing them to project a sense of victory despite internal economic damage, complicating the negotiation landscape.
Talking of economic damage, how bad is it actually getting for Iran? Is this all bluff and bluster, or are they genuinely hurting?
The economy has been severely impacted, with airstrikes targeting key industries like steel, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals, as detailed in the recent reports. However, that economic hardship hasn't compelled the regime to collapse. Instead, it's provided them with a narrative of resistance and defiance, and crucially, the Strait of Hormuz gives them a new bargaining chip.
They're inflicting pain on themselves to inflict pain on everyone else. That's a particularly unpleasant form of leverage.
It's a high-stakes strategy rooted in a uniquely dangerous ideological framework, the cult of Mahdism, which views war as a precursor to the return of the Imam Mahdi. This amplifies their willingness to accept significant economic hardship.
Okay, that's deeply unsettling. So what are we looking at in terms of oil markets? Are we headed for $100, $120 a barrel?
Citigroup's prediction of $110 a barrel if disruptions continue is a realistic baseline, but $100 a barrel is very possible. Krishner and the team noted that sustaining above $100 is a recipe for disaster. But the key point is that, as Rosenwald and Stainer highlight, the U.S. economy is demonstrably more efficient in energy usage than it was a few decades prior, lessening its direct vulnerability. Developing nations are far more exposed.
The U.S. can absorb the shock better than, say, India.
The implication runs deeper. Europe is also demonstrating resilience, with Rosenwald and Stainer noting they've already overcome a significant energy crisis, the 2022 gas shortages. Yet fuel supply is reliant on the Strait of Hormuz, but demand adjustment via higher prices and reduced flight volume is expected, already visible with 300 to 400% price increases for some routes.
300 to 400%? That's a significant deterrent to a spontaneous weekend getaway.
The pattern is clear, that's the market self-correcting. However, the broader point is that the U.S. conflict with Iran may inadvertently incentivize Gulf states to reassess their geopolitical alignment, shifting closer to China, not through choice, but through anger over perceived abandonment.
We've been circling around this China factor the whole time. It seems like they're the quiet winner in this scenario. Are they stockpiling oil, preparing for the worst?
Thompson posits that China likely strategically stockpiled oil at relatively low prices in June 2023, anticipating potential disruptions, a reasonable hypothesis considering oil prices at the time. Their reliance on the Strait of Hormuz presents a medium-term vulnerability, even greater than the Malacca Strait, due to their substantial energy investments in Iran.
And the Belt and Road initiatives? Is that still a thing, or has this conflict completely derailed it?
The viability of the pipeline from the Gulf through Pakistan is crucial, and its failure to date represents a significant obstacle. Thompson specifically notes it has not delivered yet, forcing China to rely on less successful alternatives like Russia and the Great Northern Sea Route.
So it's a logistical nightmare, a geopolitical minefield, and a potentially catastrophic economic disruption all rolled into one. What's the bottom line? What are we actually looking at here?
The bottom line is a deeply unstable situation with significant downside risk. The U.S. and Iran are communicating through intermediaries, a dance in the wordplay, as Wald put it, creating a dangerous potential for miscommunication. President Trump's attempts to project optimism are driven by domestic markets, not geopolitical realities, creating a disconnect between expectations and the likely outcome. The Gulf states are accelerating infrastructure investment, around $160 billion over the next few years, but due to anticipated longer-term need for redundancy, even if the immediate crisis resolves.
It all feels incredibly precarious. The new leadership in Iran is consolidated, emboldened, and operating under a dangerous ideological framework, and China is quietly positioning itself to benefit from the chaos. But frankly, what happens next is anyone's guess. The ceasefire is set to expire, and the U.S. and Iran are negotiating through a haze of mistrust. It's entirely possible we see a further escalation, a prolonged standoff, or against all odds, a genuine breakthrough. The lack of clarity on any of those scenarios, that uncertainty, is itself the biggest risk. Because without knowing how this plays out, it's impossible to assess the real impact on global supply chains, investment flows, and the broader geopolitical landscape, particularly as it relates to the shifting power balance between the U.S. and China. And that ultimately is what makes this so dangerous.
And that uncertainty, Maya, creates space for entirely new variables, like the shift to national champions and strategic industries, as Sweeney outlined, and how those competing priorities will reshape market dynamics going forward.
Paul Donovan at UBS is saying central banks are flying blind and the data is lying to us. That feels apt considering everything.
It's the lag effect of consumer savings masking the true impact of energy prices that's particularly concerning. We're seeing a distorted picture of economic health right now, and that almost guarantees inappropriate policy responses, specifically interest rate decisions. The Fed's attempts to address housing affordability with rate cuts, as David Kelly points out, are just kicking the can down the road. It was low rates after the financial crisis that inflated those asset bubbles in the first place.
Right, because if you artificially depress the cost of capital, things get expensive. It's not rocket science. But isn't the bigger issue who benefits from this artificial propping up? The top 20% already receive 52.2% of pre-tax income, a significant jump from 43.5% in 1974.
So here's the picture. It's not just income, it's wealth accumulation. That's where the private credit fund surge comes in, $2 billion since 2017, not because of increased investment opportunities, but because wealth managers are strategically capitalizing on evergreen funds favored by high net worth individuals. This is further exacerbated by AI. While AI development itself is currently inflationary, due to the demand for electricity and compute, the distribution of the productivity gains will overwhelmingly favor those already at the top.
It's like putting a turbocharger on a system already skewed towards the wealthy. Disinflationary potential is interesting, but who gets to enjoy it? The decline in union power, falling from 26% in 1974 to 10% in 2025, directly contributes to that inequality suppressing inflation, but also widening the gap.
Consider this, it's not accidental. This is where we start seeing the emergence of national champions and the realignment of global economic power. Consider the geopolitical implications, the focus on friendshoring and onshoring. It's all about securing supply chains within preferred nations, often at the expense of broader economic efficiency. It's like restoring a classic car. You can focus on perfect originality, prioritizing local parts and skilled labor, but it'll be infinitely more expensive and less accessible than a mass-produced model.
That's a surprisingly apt analogy, actually. So we're trading efficiency for control and exacerbating wealth disparity in the process. What's the Fed's role in all this besides politely looking the other way?
Warsh's confirmation hearings are key. Will he prioritize addressing immediate economic issues like PCE inflation, potentially reaching 3.9% by May 2026, or acknowledge the longer-term disinflationary potential of AI? Because if they're solely focused on short-term inflation targets, they're ignoring the structural issues, as Kelly warns. They're limited in their ability to address inequality directly, but they can at least avoid policies that make it worse.
But even measuring the impact of AI is a nightmare. Improvements in medical diagnostics, for example, might go unrecognized in traditional inflation or productivity measures. And let's not forget the negative impacts, social isolation, job displacement, entirely invisible to standard accounting.
And the speed of adoption is unprecedented. Gallup data shows 50% of employees reporting AI usage in Q1 2026, up from 21% in Q2 2023. That's a faster acceleration than any prior technological revolution, which means the economic effects will be more rapid and more disruptive than we anticipate. This accelerates the K-economy dynamic, where the top 10% thrive while the majority struggle.
The ketamine economy, as Scott Galloway calls it, disassociative, where market performance is detached from reality. It's unsettling, and it's fueled by the idea that the bottom 99% are just nutrition for the top 1%, predicated on a false belief in upward mobility.
It is unsettling, and that discontent is intensifying. Empathy towards figures like Luigi Mangini, growing online resentment towards tech leaders, it points to a potential for broader societal unrest. This isn't just about economic numbers, it's about a fundamental shift in public perception.
What about the national champions part? How do they fit into this picture of increasing wealth disparity?
These nations are prioritizing strategic industries, AI, semiconductors, green technology, and actively supporting their domestic champions through subsidies, protectionist measures, and state-directed investment. It's Rich Clarida's point about supply shocks becoming as significant as demand shocks. The U.S. may be entering an era where geopolitical events and industrial policy fundamentally change the policymaking environment.
And if the Fed's credibility is tested, 6 years of above-target inflation coupled with increasing government deficits, that creates a much more challenging situation. Clarida notes that markets are already pricing in fiscal risk, evidenced by higher term premiums in bond markets, but that doesn't mean it won't destabilize.
It doesn't. And that leads to a potential once-bitten, twice-shy consumer psychology regarding inflation. People remember the COVID-19 experience, and they're more likely to anticipate price increases even with moderate shocks like tariff increases. That's why it's so critical to track nominal GDP growth alongside real GDP. Clarida pointed to 2021, with 12% nominal growth despite 6-7% real growth, as an example of supply constraints not being fully appreciated in real time.
Okay, so we're dealing with distorted data, increasing wealth disparity, national champions, and a potential loss of central bank credibility. What does this mean for investors?
It means reevaluating the value proposition of complex, higher-fee investment alternatives versus broad market indexes. AI tools are making it easier for investors to understand expenses, leading to increased scrutiny of private credit fund fees. It also means recognizing that the current market success is largely driven by the top 10% and strong corporate earnings. Scott Galloway anticipates a market reversal by the end of 2026, driven by geopolitical volatility and unpredictable investor sentiment.
Basically, it's a house of cards built on a very narrow foundation. What about concrete indicators? Anything we should be watching?
The data tells a story. Monitor Amazon's retail revenue growth through 2032. Galloway predicts it could double due to the deployment of their 1 million industrialized robots. It's a clear example of a national champion leveraging AI to create significant shareholder value while simultaneously reducing personnel costs. And crucially, keep an eye on Microsoft's performance. Ed Elson doubled his position at $380 share, believing it's currently undervalued, despite being down 12% year-to-date, a contrarian bet based on the SaaSpocalypse panic. Look for a rebound there by May 1st, 2026.
Amazon and Microsoft then. Because if the robots take all the jobs, at least someone's stock price will go up. And as we watch those valuations, let's remember that the real disruption will be in enterprise AI, where Anthropic is seeing 80% of new spend, a shift that could force many software-driven assumptions to be reevaluated. So 6 months ago, everyone was chasing the chatbot dragon building the next ChatGPT. Now, it feels like the real action is happening quietly in the background. Let's talk about the AI revolution, enterprise adoption, and compute power.
The market's rapid pivot is remarkable. We're seeing an almost wholesale shift from consumer-facing models to enterprise applications, specifically around coding and workflow automation. Anthropic surged past OpenAI in revenue. $30 billion ARR compared to $25 billion is the clearest evidence of that, and 80% of that is coming from businesses.
$30 billion. That's not a side hustle. And it's not, as they like to say, democratizing AI. It's paying customers. KPMG's client zero approach is a polite way of saying we're selling expensive stuff to big companies.
Stepping back, that's a critical distinction. OpenAI was building a broad base, hoping to monetize scale. Anthropic seems to have identified a more lucrative, albeit narrower, path, deeply integrated solutions for power users, cloud code being the flagship example, and clients willing to pay a premium for demonstrable ROI. The 1,000 customers spending over $1 million annually speaks volumes.
Speaking of cloud code, it's interesting they're positioning Claude Design as a wrapper rather than a full Figma replacement. It's like saying, we're not here to tear down your existing tools, just make them a lot more powerful.
That's a very astute observation. It's a strategic play to mitigate competitive risk, especially given the recent resignation of Figma's former CPO, Mike Krieger, from the Figma board. The Friday release and soft launch timing were almost certainly calculated to avoid a direct confrontation and soften any potential disruption.
They're easing in the disruption one wireframe at a time. Greg Eisenberg's 9-10 rating for wireframing suggests it is good. But the rate limiting issues are a bit of a red flag, aren't they? Justine Moore hitting her max plan limit in 30 minutes.
It's a classic demand exceeds supply problem, but also an indication of genuine interest. More importantly, it highlights a fundamental constraint on AI deployment, compute power. That's where the Cerebras story becomes crucial. They're not just building chips, they're positioning themselves as a direct competitor to NVIDIA, and their $10 billion deal with OpenAI underscores the critical need for alternative infrastructure.
So OpenAI is burning cash on Sora, shutting it down $1 to $15 million a day, while Anthropic is doing more with less. 4 times less training compute, according to Kevin Whale. That's not just efficiency, that's a completely different business model.
It speaks to a shift in enterprise AI strategy, focusing on inference time compute and agent orchestration. Blitzy's emphasis on deeply reasoning agents capable of building complex applications, rather than simple code generation, exemplifies that. It's not about how much data you pre-train, but what your agent can do with that data in real time.
Agentic coding. Another bit of jargon. Basically, letting the computer figure things out instead of babysitting it line by line.
Essentially, yes. But the opportunity goes beyond coding. The bulk of an engineer's work is context management and communication, not just writing code, so workflow orchestration tools, Zenflow Work, for example, become vital. The earlier OpenClaw attempts failed because of security and functional concerns. It seems those are now being addressed.
The sliders in Claude design are the killer feature apparently nobody is talking about. SmartApe on Twitter said so. Direct manipulation of design elements instead of endless prompting, that's a fundamentally different interaction paradigm.
It represents a move away from purely generative AI towards a more collaborative process. And the fact that it can extract and maintain visual consistency from existing branded decks without a formal guide, Nufar Gaspar called that a key differentiator, is significant. It lowers the barrier to entry for non-designers and emphasizes integration with existing brand systems.
So if Figma is worried, it's not about becoming obsolete overnight. It's about Anthropic becoming the engine inside Figma. Like a superpower.
It's a telling detail. That's why Anthropic is targeting cloud code power users and emphasizing the value of a broader AI strategy. It's not just about individual tools, but about the entire workflow ecosystem.
Except that workflow ecosystem needs more energy. 130 gigawatts of additional data center power by 2028, potentially leaving a 10 to 20% shortfall in US power availability.
This is where the macro, geopolitical, and energy themes converge. AI's continued expansion is physically constrained by energy capacity. And that constraint will likely accelerate investment in energy security and alternative infrastructure.
The gold rush within the App Store ecosystem, a 60% YoY increase in launches, 104% in April, isn't a sign that AI is just a hype cycle. It's a direct consequence of tools like Replit lowering the barrier to entry.
Correct. It's not a counter-narrative to the chatbot focus, but evidence of it. AI is enabling a new wave of app development, and that demand is directly straining compute resources.
Okay, so what's the thing to watch? If Anthropic is really onto something and demand continues to surge, and compute remains the bottleneck.
Keep a very close eye on energy infrastructure investment, particularly focusing on projects designed to support AI-specific workloads. The pace of data center buildout, combined with advancements in energy efficiency and alternative power sources, will determine the long-term sustainability of this AI revolution. And specifically, how quickly Anthropic can secure its promised 3.5 gigawatts from Google starting in 2027. That number isn't just a commitment, it's a potential lifeline.
Stepping back from the specifics, the oil price jumps, the Anthropic ARR, the surging wealth gap, it feels like we've been mapping a single incredibly complex system. A system driven by a fundamental competition for resources, accelerated by technological change, and increasingly defined by a hardening of national interests. It's not just about energy anymore, is it? It feels less like isolated events and more like resonant ripples from a central disturbance.
Something to flag here, I think that disturbance is a shifting geopolitical axis. We talked about the US re-engagement with nations previously considered pariahs, ostensibly for energy access, but it's hard to divorce that from containment strategies aimed at China. The data points Citigroup's $110 barrel prediction, China's potential alliances with Gulf states, are symptoms of a much larger realignment. Think of it like a slow-motion volcanic upheaval. Magma shifting beneath the surface, causing tremors in energy markets and forcing new fault lines in global trade.
And the AI piece adds another layer of heat to this. Demand for compute power is exploding, creating these critical bottlenecks, and the enterprise adoption figures, KPMG's Client Zero approach, Replit's growth, suggest it's not just tech optimists driving this. It's about economic imperatives, and it's scaling faster than our ability to understand its impact. That wealth disparity figure, top 20% controlling over 52% of income, seems inextricably linked to who has access to these AI tools and the infrastructure powering them.
Two things stand out. The standard economic indicators are struggling to keep pace. We're measuring the output of AI, but not the underlying shift in the distribution of power and capital. And that's where the risk lies. The scramble for compute, Anthropic's Google deal, Cerebra's OpenAI contract, isn't just technological competition, it's a zero-sum game for economic advantage. It's like we're all restoring classic cars, individually optimizing for efficiency, but ignoring the fact that the road itself is crumbling.
But then you have the private credit surge, the Amazon predictions, signs of continued growth, even doubling of retail revenue by 2032. So is it just a house of cards, or is there genuine innovation happening amidst the chaos? Are we simply seeing an acceleration of existing trends or something fundamentally new?
That's the unresolved tension, isn't it? The market could easily reverse course by the end of 2026. Scott was right to anticipate volatility, but Microsoft's stock price, despite the SaaSpocalypse panic, feels like a contrarian indicator. And watching those Gulf states reassess their priorities, driven by concerns about US commitment, that's where the real uncertainty lies.
It's a dance in the wordplay, a potentially dangerous one. Securing those 3.5 gigawatts of power by 2027 feels critical. And honestly, it's hard to shake the feeling that the true motivation of US foreign policy, energy security versus China, remains shrouded in ambiguity.
Agreed. It's a uniquely dangerous ideological framework, prioritizing national interests to the detriment of collective stability. And while we can predict oil prices reaching $100 barrel or higher, or Amazon's growth trajectory, it's the unpredictable escalations, the Iran situation, the Belt and Road Initiative's fate that keep me, and I suspect all of us, holding our breath.
Well, a lot to watch. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow with another Daily Digest.